Coming to you direct from the nerve center of the galaxy's greatest comic. This is the 2000 AD Thrillcast.
Borag Thong, Earthlets, and welcome to another 2000 AD Thrillcast. I am Molchar, and my vocal diodes have been nicely repaired after the slight incident at New York Comic Con. Apologies for the croakiness in the last episode. We're going to get straight on with it this week to talk about Dan Dare. Now, for those of you who don't know or who only know Dan Dare from being the sort of pipe and slippers, old school comic book from the Eagle back in the 1950s. Dan Dare was one of the first strips to appear in 2000 AD back in 1977. And this coming November, just in time for Christmas, nudge, nudge, we are producing the first volume of the reprinted stories. Now, this is significant because these stories have never been reprinted in their entirety before. This is a Deluxe edition with hardback, with the color pages restored, with new scans of artwork. It's a gorgeous, wonderful collection that really brings out the detail in the artwork from two absolute grandmasters of British comics, and that is Massimo Ballardinelli and Dave Gibbons. You've also got some great writing in there from Pat Mills, Kelvin Gosnell, Steve Moore, and we've got Jerry Finley Day in there as well. This is a wonderful time capsule of the very dawn of 2000 AD, when Dan Dare was the big character name brought in to help boost this fledgling comic. And it's fantastic that on this edition of the 2000 AD Thrillcast, we have both Pat Mills and Dave Gibbons to talk about their experiences working on this seminal strip for early 2000 AD. Before we crack on with that, I just want to give everyone a reminder to sign up to the 2000 AD Thrill Mail. Now, this is our weekly newsletter, which goes out every Wednesday and gives you the lowdown and the backstory on what's happening with 2000 AD, all our new releases, and letting you know what's coming up in the future. We're also giving out free comics as part of it, and you get a little glimpse back into the history of 2000 AD with our classic covers. And don't forget, if you enjoy the 2000 AD Thrillcast, and I know many of you do because you've let me know, please do spread the word on your social media, amongst your friends, amongst anybody you know who likes comics or comics history. And, you know, if you're on iTunes, maybe go and give us a little bit of a star rating on there. That'd be very much appreciated. Don't forget, we also need your questions for Tharg the Mighty. In the next episode of the 2000 AD Thrillcast, we're going to be putting your questions directly to the Mighty One himself. So whether you want to know something about 2000 AD's history, whether you want to know about something that's coming up, or whether you want to ask a question about something that's running currently in the prog or the magazine, then please do drop us a line at thrillcast@2000adonline.com. That's thrillcast@2000adonline.com. We won't be able to get Tharg himself on because clearly his voice would just burst everybody's eardrums with its mightiness. So we will be talking to his chief editorial droid, Cybermat. So to celebrate the coming release in November of Dan Dare, the 2000 AD Years, Volume 1, it's my absolute pleasure to welcome the creator of 2000 AD and writer on many of its greatest strips, Mr. Pat Mills. Welcome back to the podcast, Pat.
Hi, Michael. Hi.
So we're talking about Dan Dare, which was a strip that first appeared in the very first episode of, the very first issue of 2000 AD. Do you want to tell us about how this sort of icon of sort of pipe and slippers, old style British comics managed to find his way into this punk infused bad boy of late 70s comics?
Sure. let me think. When I started 2000 AD, we really needed everything we could get to make it happen, because there was a lot of resistance within the industry to our success. And there was a stage, for example, where it looked like 2000 AD might have been glossy, like TV21 and various other things. That fell through, and therefore I had the problem of how do you make a science fiction comic on bog paper compete with all these gloss? I mean, bear in mind, there was loads of them. There's Lookin' and TV21 and then Eagle in the Past and so on. And it was almost a given that a science fiction comic had to be on glossy paper. And here we were coming out on bog paper. And that punk sensibility that you referred to was always an undertow in the thing. It was never sort of right out there in front. It was there, but it was kind of understated. Mm. So in the case of Dan Dare, what we had was if we came out with Dan Dare, it was going to automatically boost sales.
Yeah.
So that was the reason for it. And I think despite everything, it worked. It helped to boost sales in those critical first 3 months.
Because also one of the things that inspired the creation of 2000 AD at IPC was, of course, that Star Wars was coming out in 1977. Was there a sense in sort of reimagining this what had been a very popular character, but that had not been in print for a number of years? Was there a sense of this kind of new aesthetic about space? You know, it was exciting, it was dangerous, it was different, it was a little bit gritty.
Not actually in that way. Mm. I mean, later versions of Dan Dare were influenced by Star Wars. Probably for the worst, I would say, on balance.
Sure.
But when we were coming out, we were actually ahead of Star Wars by, you could look it up, but from the top of my head, I think it would be some 6 months to a year, certainly 6 months. And actually, when Star Wars came out, 2000 AD sales actually went down a bit.
Oh, right.
because, I mean, this is sort of one of those unpalatable things because, and I mean, we can all guess the reason, but my own guess is that some kids who were hanging on to 2000 AD because it was science fiction then found a more palatable form of science fiction from, say, the Marvel Star Wars. In other words, it was pressing a lot of people, I think, bought 2000 AD because it was science fiction. So anything that gives you fantasy and so on. We went through endless variations to try and, to try and get Dan Dare right, to make it work and so on. And I think it's worth saying at this point that, I mean, if you think of Doctor Who, for example, it's gone through a variety of reincarnations. Some have been successful, some not so successful. But, you know, there is that thing that you kind of move with the times, but you keep the essential formula. Mm. And so, yes, I mean, it can work. It can be done. But it's a formidable task on Dan Dare. And I would imagine on Doctor Who, every time they change the Doctor.
So the Dan Dare that first appeared in 2000 AD is, obviously, as we've said, different. But he's the same character, just revived from suspended animation after 200 years to find himself in a very different world. As you say, he went through various incarnations in the lead up to the publication of 2000 AD. What was the tone that you were striking for when you were reimagining this classic character?
I think it came down to what an artist could make work. I mean, particularly with a space story. Space stories are actually the hardest kind of story, and you've only got to look at, say, 2000 AD. Over the last few years to see that there are, relatively speaking, not that many full-on spaceship stories. They're very hard to do and to get right. Mm. So I think you start by, you're at the mercy of the artist. So if you have an artist who can really recreate a certain mood and tone, then you fashion the story accordingly. So my first approach was to think, well, when Dan Dare was originally created, 1950. It was very much a reflection of the technology of its time. Therefore, it seemed logical to me to go in for a whole NASA approach. And that was pretty far developed, actually, on a number of levels, designs of spaceships, pages of artwork, scripts, and so on. And I kept looking at it, and I kept thinking, not that it was wrong or out of place in 2000 AD, it just wasn't strong enough. You know, it's not the NASA approach isn't wrong, but you've got to give it that extra bit of heart. And I thought to myself, no, you know what? This is going to appeal to SF buffs, and I don't give a shit about them. I'm after kids who are reading 2000 AD. Maybe it's the first science fiction they've ever read. I'm not appealing to aficionados or purists. They were never high on my agenda. It's the kid in the street I wanted to appeal to. And I thought, you know what? This isn't going to work for them. I'm going to have to rethink this. And so we rethought it. Probably, I don't know, maybe it went through a couple of incarnations, and time was running perilously out when Bilardinelli, purely on spec, just did some pages straight out of the blue. And what they were able to do, and I think it still holds up to this day, is they made a fantastic world look incredible on bog paper. And that's the trick. I mean, we're on the crudest possible paper. And you look at Bilardinelli's artwork, and you have this beautiful line work, this fantastic alien world, which in this case is Jupiter. And there are difficulties and there are problems with it, but the planet itself, the monsters and so forth, they work. And that was reflected in the reader's generally positive response to it.
We had Garth Ennis on the last edition of the Thrillcast, and he was talking about the impact that Bilardinelli's artwork had on him. And in particular, the way that a lot of the sci-fi that he'd read before was in the direction that you were talking about then, that you initially went more towards kind of NASA-y, realistic kind of space travel.
A bit stodgy.
Yeah. But with Bilardinelli, just the kind of organo-technical world that he evoked, it was just incredible, wasn't it?
Well, it's really good to hear you say that, and for Garth to say that too, because for a long while, Bilardinelli's work was not reprinted, and it's taken Rebellion to actually give him the status, give his work the status it truly deserves. He was frozen out for a long time, and there are imperfections in his work, but you could say that about all of us. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Say, well, this guy's dialogue isn't right, or that guy's anatomy isn't right, and so on. But it's good to know that. And I think it's such a shame it's taken so long. And I think that's why I think this collection, which is the very first time what many would regard as Bilardinelli's finest work, is finally seeing the light of day. And it was amazing stuff. I mean, what's just come through my mind is just thinking back, and sometimes his work was so incredible and so intense, we actually had to break it down and reformulate the pages because it was too much on one single page. There was a lot of work went on behind the scenes with Dan Dare, and it's nice to know that, you know, it's finally getting that recognition, which it really does deserve.
I was going to ask you what it's like to see a strip that hasn't been reprinted for various reasons actually emerge into the light and be presented in, you know, in what is, let's face it, a nice format. You know, it's hardback, it's nice glossy pages, it's good scans of the artwork.
It's going to be beautiful, isn't it? Yeah. It's very gratifying for me personally, and it's lovely to know that Massimo's work has really got that recognition that it deserved, because he was marginalized in the past. So this is, it's really good that Rebellion is really in tune with the readers from that era who are looking for, you know, all their favourite stories from that that time to come back and be collected.
Sure. Now, one of the things that you've kind of touched on there is the reaction to this reimagining of Dan Dare at the time. Now, in a blog post you did a little while ago, you mentioned that your publisher, John Sanders, when he agreed that you were going to revive Dan Dare, he told you not to worry about the original fans because, as I said, there was quite a gap between the Eagle ending and 2000 AD starting up. What was it? Was it difficult to strike a balance between those expecting the old and those looking for the new? And also, did any criticism from old school fans of the Eagle stuff weigh you down a little bit at all?
I think that's well observed. They did weigh me down a little bit. They shouldn't have done. And in terms of continuity between the old and the new, there was none. There was none whatsoever. I think this was an era where, and I mean, I think it probably still happens to a certain extent. I don't know how far the continuity on Bond, you know, how good that is. So I think from a commercial point of view, the continuity actually wasn't that important. From an aesthetic point of view, I think it was. And I think for me personally, you know, I've looked back on that with some regret and have sort of tried to redress it over the years. But that's purely, if you like, an aesthetic value. It's not a commercial one. Mm-hmm. You know, because I think the readers, for the most part, said, you know, look, it's exciting, it's powerful, and you know, that was all they were looking for. They weren't turning around and saying, "Well, my dad hates it." Well, a few of them probably did, but it didn't. You know, my dad read it in 1950, and it's nothing like it. And I think later on, in New Eagle, I actually tried to recreate the original essence. And I think that works too. But as I say, for our purposes and in the time we had, you know, I think Ballard and Elise, well, it worked. I mean, the story, but you know what? I wanted it to actually be, I didn't actually want any story to be a number one story. I mean, if it happened as it did with Dread, fine. But what I really wanted was a collection of very, very successful stories, not, you know, one lead story and also rans. And Dan Dare was about number three, maybe number four out of a group of six stories. And I wanted him to be a bit higher. And so that explains the subsequent changes that we went through to try and push him further.
Sure. Well, on the second story, it was Steve Moore who came on scripting. Was that part of you trying to push things in a slightly different direction?
On the first story, I think Kelvin and I had been writing it in between me sort of finishing my stint on the comic and then Kelvin taking over. And so, you know, it wasn't physically possible for me to write Dan Dare. And I was very impressed with Steve Moore's science fiction background. Mm. And, you know, he wrote some of the early Future Shocks. And I felt that he would strike a balance between what you might call old school SF and the new direction we were going. And that ran for a while. And I think, once again, was from memory, I think was reasonably popular once more. But again, I wanted it to be stronger yet. In other words, I really wanted it to be a very, very popular story. And hence, just before I left, I thought, well, okay, why don't we go for Dave Gibbons, who's such a terrific artist? because Harlem Heroes he'd been working on was rather limited by the fact it was a death game where we weren't allowed to have anyone killed. So it's a bit of a waste of a kind of rollerball type story, which I was pretty gutted about. So I felt that Dave's talents were being underused on Harlem Heroes. And what I really wanted was a safe pair of writing hands and a safe pair of art hands so that I could leave this story with its incredible heritage in safe hands. And so it went over to Dave and to Jerry Finley Day on the writing side.
Yeah, of course, Jerry, so well known for Rogue Trooper and the VCs and Harry 20 on the High Rock and all these wonderful kind of high concept ideas. Under his tenure, the character did take quite a slightly more radical turn as things went along, and with Dave's more kind of action SF style to his artwork, it seemed like the strip that started in Prog One with yourself and Kelvin and Ballard and Ellie was now very different to the one that was maturing in the pages of 2000 AD.
Yeah, I think that's probably true, and I suppose the bottom line on this is that Dan Dare is a high maintenance story. I like to think that we pretty much got the first story right. We got the bad guys right. I mean, you know, you've got Jupiter's Red Spot. I mean, my thinking here, incidentally, that there is a little bit of continuity insofar as the original Dan Dare story. They go to Venus. So in the 1970s, well, where's the place to go? What about going to Jupiter? So they've got high gravity suits, and you've got the most appalling aliens who, you know, they really are absolutely revolting. The biogs and the sort of humanoid creatures involved with them and so on. I mean, I think they could give the Treens a pretty good run for their money. But, you know, I think to maintain... to see where one is going right and wrong on Dan Dare, it is a process. And if you consider how many versions I went through to get to that point, it's possible that along the lines, you know, where, you know, Dave is a classic artist, and it's possible that he didn't always get the scripts that perhaps he should have done. And I think after all this process and then discovering, you know, subsequent revivals and so on, I think that's why on New Eagle, I thought, you know what, I'm going to go back and do this again as a kind of penance. And I'm going to try and do it old school, but with a kind of modern edge. So, you know, that's obviously a story for another day. But, it is a bit rough when a character is, part of... almost part of the national psyche, you know, so it's a byword. And as I say, this is more a matter for, you know, an aesthetic issue and an issue for, aficionados and so on. But, I think the thing is, don't mess with the formula is probably the bottom line. Because if you do, you know, you'll constantly be updating, changing, you know, altering the character's look and so on. And of course, that's actually what happened. Mm.
There can't be many creators in British comics who've had the opportunity to reinvent a classic character twice in a relatively short space of time.
No, that's true. And the story on New Eagle was equally fraught with problems. I mean, we were landed with all kinds of difficulties, not least the fact that it's not actually Dan Dare, it's his great-grandson or something. And, you know, and you're stuck with all these protocols because of merchandising and copyright and everything else. But, yeah, I like to think, I can remember actually sitting down and thinking, oh, sod it. You know, let's forget this, him having a power arm or you know, being a, you know, an old guy with a walking stick or whatever it is. Let's just go right back to how it should be done. And I think it worked. I mean, I did it with Ian Kennedy, who I would say is very much a, you know, has inherited that that tradition of Frank Hampson. And then having got it as right as I possibly could, I thought, okay, now I'm going to run for the hills and I'm just getting out of here. I've got it right. I'm sorry, Frank, for messing around with your character. But now it's time for me to go.
Brilliant. I mean, how important do you think having Dan Dare in Prog number one of 2000 AD was to the survival of 2000 AD?
I don't think it was vital to the survival. I think it was an important story. I think from the point of view of Prog 1, the thing that it's always worth remembering that the number one story for the first, whatever it was, best part of the first 3 months, certainly the first 10 issues approximately, was Mac 1, which I loved saying to people because no one really wants to hear that. And I go, yes, it's true. I'm sorry, guys. It's true. It's Mac 1. And that's because we do become more kind of purist as we get older, and you know, we don't really want to remember sort of I don't know, some of the glam rock we were into or whatever. We'd rather forget all about it. But yeah, and that was a very cold-blooded decision on my part, which is, I think it's very, very important if you want to produce a successful comic for kids rather than for aficionados at conventions, you have to approach it in a rather humble way. Mm. And there was plenty of humility on my part because I thought, okay, we do something like the $6 million man, this comic is going to fly out the door. And it did. So Mac 1 was probably the single most important thing. I mean, after all, Judge Dredd's an acquired taste. You know what I mean? you know, it's like a wine, drinking wine for the first time. You've got to get used to it, kind of thing. So that we knew that would take time. Equally, Dan Dare was pulling readers in. It's possible it could have pushed a few out as well, but not that many, I think. I mean, after all, it's a bog paper comic, and I think you've always got to remember the original Eagle was a middle class comic aimed at middle class kids, and there weren't that many of them on 2000 AD. There was a very strong class divide in comics in those days. We were all very aware of it. There's a bit of class war going on, you know?
What do you think is the legacy of Dan Dare, not just for 2000 AD, but for you and for British comics? Because when often we see things online or there's newspaper articles talking about, you know, the most popular British characters, who's the biggest British comic book character, and you get a very clear divide, particularly in terms of age, between those who say Judge Dredd and those who say Dan Dare. So what do you think has the legacy been for British comics of 2080's revival of Dan Dare?
I thought you were going to say the original one. I could be quite euphoric about that. I'm a big fan of the original one. The legacy as far as 2000 AD's Dan Dare is concerned, and that's excluding all the numerous other versions lurking around. That's a tough one. Not as, yeah, it didn't register in the same way as other 2000 AD characters, you know, maybe one notch below Dredd, so to speak. So, you know, if you were to say, you know, after Dredd, what might you say? You might say Rogue Trooper or Slain or ABC Warriors or whatever. Dan Dare would be much further down the list, I'm afraid. And I think that's a shame. You know, I think Ballardinelli's artwork was very, very important. And I think Dave's was, in terms of, you know, Dave needed to move on to something stronger than Harlem Heroes. My take on it is he didn't have the scripts that he really deserved. Mm. And bear in mind, we were desperately short of writers at that point in time. I mean, that's the reason I ended up writing, most of the the early stuff, because it's actually easier for me to write it than to, try and train up writers who really didn't get it. They no one really got 2000 AD until it came out. So sadly, I think Dan Dare's legacy is not as strong as it should have been. I wish I could say something more positive, but I think perhaps one way of putting it is there were so many strong stories competing, if you like, for that number two space, after Dread. And I think maybe they just pushed Dan Dare down the list a little bit, Flesh or, Road Trooper, whatever.
Yeah, because I think a lot of people don't really realise that Dread wasn't number one until quite some time after 2000 AD had started.
That's right.
But yeah, I think you're right. In those early stories, I mean, we have so much feedback from people who remember. It's something we discussed with Garth in the last episode. The strength of all these strips, you've got Flesh, you've got Invasion, you've got Dan Dare, you've got Mac One. And yeah, I think you're right. It's kind of hard to pick a winner out of all of those.
And that was kind of deliberate. Mm. In other words, I wanted every story to be a potential winner. And ironically, the story which was the initial winner is probably the one that sort of died without too many regrets by anyone now. And it's actually also, and I say this as someone who wrote who developed it, wrote it, and so on. It's actually the hardest bloody story to do because you've got a 6-page story, which generally was self-contained, and whereas asking writers to give novel-like twists within 6 pages, no pressure there. I mean, it was a killer. And this is the other thing, of course, is that when you have a reality story like Mac One, where you're it's set in a modern time, so you have to have modern aircraft or modern tanks or whatever. You've got to get the technology right. You don't have to do that with science fiction. So it made it a really tough story for writers, and no one really wanted to write it. So I think sometimes stories, die by neglect because no one is that interested in them. So in the case of Mac One, it was a killer to write financially. It's much easier to write science fiction. And in the case of Dan Dare, all that pressure on people, it really needed someone to come along and say, okay, right, I'm going to make this my own. I'm going to sort this out. I'm going to make a name for myself. And unfortunately, Garth was only 9 or 10 at the time. He wasn't there. Sorry, Garth. But, if he had been, I'm sure he would have come in and said, okay, I'm going to sort this out. And but I think that's the thing. There was a shortage of writers who were really committed to the story. You've got to be really committed to something like that and sort it out. I mean, you've only got to look at any number of 2000 AD stories to see how writers from time to time have turned stories around, invested energy in it, and that, of course, goes for artists as well. And that's probably what it needed. And I think there were desperate attempts towards the end of Dan Dare's life in 2000 AD to do that. But the trouble is, once you start changing direction one way and then another way and another way, you often lose the readers. They get pissed.
Well, it's I think the joy of these new volumes that we're producing, I think
how many are there, by the way?
I think there's going to be two.
Good. Okay, that second one is going to be very interesting as well, because there's some great artwork in there I some really noir black and white artwork.
Yeah, well, it's going to be really interesting to see people's reaction to the breadth of artistic talent, because you know it wasn't that long after Dan Dare that Dave was off to do Watchmen, you know, to become one of the big names in comics. So it's fascinating in itself. It's fascinating of for its legacy and all the people involved. So it's really interesting. And for myself, you know, I wasn't even born when 2000 AD came out, but not to make anyone feel too old, but you know, for me to discover this for the first time in that format, you know, rather than having to leave through old issues, but it's going to be great. We've run out of time, but thank you so much for that, Pat. It was great to talk to you, and thank you for your insights into this, what is going to be a fascinating collection for people to read.
When's it out, Michael?
It's out in November.
I'm going to look forward to it.
Excellent, lovely. Well, thanks again, Pat.
Cheers. Bye bye now.
Well, I hope you enjoyed listening to Pat as much as I just enjoyed chatting to him. Some great insights into the very dawn of 2000 AD. Now, of course, as we said, Dan Dare was just one of those strips that appeared in that first issue alongside such incredible strips as Flesh and Mac One and Invasion. One of the artists who was in those early issues, but not necessarily on Dan Dare, but eventually came later, was Dave Gibbons, who we've already discussed. Very different artist to Belardinelli, but brought his own trademark style to the strip as it changed direction. And it's a great privilege to welcome Dave Gibbons to the Thrillcast. Welcome, Dave.
Thank you very much, Mike. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Dan Dare, it wasn't your first rodeo in terms of comics work, shall we say, but it's certainly one that amongst our readership retains a lot of affection, and with the new collection coming up in November, there's an even wider audience of people who get to see it for the first time. Can you remember how you came to be working on the strip?
Yeah, I mean, I've been with 2000 AD from the first issue. I drew Harlem Heroes for quite a while. I mean, it must have been 3 or 4 months, I would think, while Belardinelli was doing Dan Dare. And then I was offered the chance to do Dan Dare, which I really found impossible to refuse because I've been a huge fan of the character growing up, obviously in the Frank Hampson incarnation of it, which was a wonderful Technicolor oasis in the greyness of the 50s when I was a lad. And so, yeah, it was the kind of offer that I couldn't say no to. It was a slightly poison chalice because I had all sorts of wonderful ideas of what I wanted to do with Dan. And I remember I did sketches and wrote notes about, you know, possible storylines, only to be told that the first script had already been written and the direction was set, and that's what I had to get on with. So that was a little bit disappointing to me, but I did manfully do my best with it. And although you may ask me something later that relates to this, I'll just say that I particularly appreciate this new collection because, you know, for many years, great things have been said about Dread and about Robo Hunter and about a lot of those other strips from the early days. And to me, it seemed that Dan was a bit neglected. But certainly since this new collection has been announced, I've been, you know, really thrilled and flattered to see everybody coming out of the woodwork and saying how glad they are and how it was all along one of their favourite early 2000 AD strips.
Oh, that's brilliant. That's really nice to know from our point of view, but it's great for you. I'm coming to it completely fresh because I never read it as a kid, so it's it's a hell of a format to discover it in. We've just been chatting to Pat about the genesis of this reimagining of Dan Dare and how radically wild and unusual and just bonkers Ballardinelli's work, wasn't it?
But yeah.
Obviously, you're very different artists. Did you look at the stuff that he'd done and go, oh, I can't really do that kind of thing. I'm going to do what I want to do.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's why I was drafted on board anyway. I mean, you know, Ballardinelli's vision, I just thought was amazing and something I would never hope to emulate. I mean, I just don't see things in that way. But I think it was the kind of, what I would like to think of as the virtues of my work that made him invite me to draw it. You know, that my storytelling has always been very clear. You know, that's really the thing about comics that I've done my best to master over the years is actually telling stories clearly and coherently in pictures, which possibly, you know, Ballardinelli's stuff sometimes didn't do. And to be honest, the storylines were often of a fairly hallucinogenic kind of turn, which didn't necessarily translate into coherent narrative. So I think, you know, they wanted to set a new direction, which was Ban very much in the nuts and bolts world, you know, this very clearly realized, you know, much nearer future where there was a space station in Earth orbit that looked very like the sort of space stations you might have imagined anyway, and a really down-to-earth, you know, kind of Dirty Dozen feel to Dan and the crew. And they obviously felt that, you know, my style of storytelling was best suited to that.
Because was this the first time that you'd worked with Jerry Finley Day or... had you worked with him before?
No, this was the first time. I mean, we did later go on to create Rogue Trooper together, and yeah. I drew a few episodes of that. You know, I know Jerry's very highly respected as a comic book writer, and he did some amazingly innovative things. But his style of writing was, I used to find it slightly stream of consciousness. And I think that despite the fact that I was drawing it in a very nuts and bolts way, sometimes the laws of physics became a little bit slippery for Jerry. But certainly, I mean, he knows how to write a story to keep the reader coming back. Mm. And looking back on it now, I mean, you know, I hadn't looked at this material for a while until it might even have been you who actually sent me the PDFs of what was going to be in the collection. And I thought, well, actually, this has got an amazing momentum to it. And it barrels along. And there's galactic civilizations and warlords and pirates and vampires. You know, it was certainly a very rich and heady mix. And not trying to make a pun about the vampire connection, but it certainly gave me plenty to get my artistic teeth into.
there was something that Pat mentioned in a blog post he wrote a while ago. I mean, you mentioned the kind of nuts and bolts approach. Jerry had a successful track record as a war comics writer because of his background in the Territorial Army.
Right.
And you mentioned the kind of stream of consciousness there and physics being slightly elastic in his way. Yeah. Is it a case that with this incarnation of Dan Dare, with this new direction, relatively soon after the comic had properly established itself, Do you think the bombastic nature of it, the fact it barreled along, did it have a chance to breathe? Did it have, because a lot of the old war stories, particularly that Jerry wrote, they're kind of almost over before you realise that they've begun. Do you think the strip had time to breathe?
Well, you know, it was essentially an action adventure strip. I mean, it had to have that momentum, and I mean, just as with Harlem Heroes, I'd just drawn endless sequences of people flying through the air and chucking things at one another. You know, the Dan Dare was, you know, essentially people charging around, firing guns and blowing shit up, as they say. So I mean, it looked like there was no room to breathe. And it was written as a kind of gung-ho adventure story. I mean, I think perhaps when we got onto the episodes that were written by Chris Loder, or Jack Adrian, as he styled himself there, they became a little bit, you know, kind of eerier and perhaps a little bit more reflective and a little bit more Star Trek-y, in that there were moments of reflection and wonder. But I mean, as an artist, I certainly would always rather draw things happening than people talking about things happening. And I've always been attracted to that style of storytelling. So, I felt I had plenty of room to breathe on it anyway, even if the reader might occasionally have felt a bit overwhelmed.
Gary, you mentioned the later writers there, and of course, Tom Tully as well was somebody who worked on the strip.
Yeah.
As things went on, we ended up with the story where an amnesiac Dare is rescued from space by the Mekon and indoctrinated into his army. And you've got a quite kind of superhero costume that he's wearing. How did you sort of deal with what seemed to be a lot more of a radical redirection at the time?
It seems like I was tempted into having yet another go at getting it right, you know. And you know, my love for the character is such that I really believe that we could get it right. But I think it was a mixed success, or possibly, perhaps to be more frank, a mixed failure, because although there were some nice sequences in there, and, you know, Tom Tully is somebody's work I was reading when I was a kid. I mean, he wrote such classic things as Heroes and Spartan in the Eagle, which I absolutely love. And he certainly knows how to keep the pot boiling and knows how to hang someone off a cliff, you know. and his stories, to be honest, I found a lot more intelligible than some of the stuff that Jerry would write. And we went on this kind of super heroic angle. It never did sit, I think, quite right with Dan, and you know, that did really run out of steam, much to many readers' chagrin, that we just ended it with a ship flying off into space and Dan and his pals saying, you know, perhaps the answer lies out there somewhere. And so it did completely run out of steam. And there is something I should say, just in case I don't get the chance later, but you know, Dan Dare purists really frowned upon what was done with Dan in 2008. And I must admit, I had an odd twinge of guilt, particularly because I knew how badly Frank Hampson, the creator of Dan Dare, had been treated historically. I mean, this was long before the days of 2000 AD. But he hadn't been treated very well, and he was a slightly bitter man, I was led to believe. But I was actually introduced to him by a comics historian called Dennis Gifford, who very mischievously said, "Oh, Frank, this is Dave Gibbons. He's been drawing Dan Dare for 2000 AD and Mike, perhaps at that point, Dennis perhaps spat on the floor to show his displeasure. So I held my hand out, and Frank shook my hand, and I said to him, "You know, I loved your stuff so much as a kid growing up. I'm really sorry that I can't do it justice now." And he very graciously said to me, "Don't worry, old son, we all have to make a living." Which I thought it felt like a benediction or an absolution of some sort. And he was kind enough to sign one of my reprint albums of a classic Dan Dare story. I think it was my favorite ever, called Rogue Planet. So I felt in a way I'd made my sense with Frank Hampson. But really, I have to say, you know, in a sense, Me and Dan Dare is the story of a boyhood obsession made flesh, I think.
Well, they often say never meet your heroes, but perhaps they should also, for comics, it should be never work on your favourite characters.
Well, that's so. I mean, I think I held the original in such high regard that really nothing I could have done would, in my mind, ever quite measured up to it.
So what was the legacy of that original Dan Dare on you as an artist?
Well, I mean, you know, in the days when Frank Hampson was doing Dan Dare, he had a whole studio of artists that he was working with. I think there were 7 or 8 of them, and they had a huge budget, so they would actually build models of everything, of the spacesuits and the ships. They had a whole tabletop model of Space Fleet headquarters, and there were some fantastic draftsmen working on it, and you know, in their spare time they'd model for the parts as well. So there was always a tremendous consistency and believability and three-dimensionality to it. And, you know, that's the thing that I try to do in my work, you know, to draw things as if they actually exist, and to make sure that the continuity is constant from panel to panel, and that you never get the feeling that you're being manipulated or things are being thrown in there after the fact. You know, you sometimes in comics get people in a sealed room, and all of a sudden it turns out there's a door or even a window in it that someone enters through. And I've never liked that. So, I mean, I tend to plot out my locales and design my characters in a very sort of bulletproof, three-dimensional way. And so, you know, I suppose that was the biggest legacy, really. And I can still... You know, I can still pick up copies of The Eagle or look at old Dan Dare stuff and tell you exactly where I was when I read them and what the weather was like and who I was with. So, you know, they have stuck with me on all sorts of subconscious levels as well. And, you know, it was a shame, really, I think, that a lot of the people who worked on The Eagle didn't at the time get the global recognition they deserved. And those of us of a later generation, in fact, whose path was sort of paved by those pioneers, we've been much luckier in the sort of reception and audience that our work has got.
I've always thought it very interesting, and Pat sort of elaborated a bit on this when we chatted to him earlier, to reboot a character like Dan Dare for the beginning of this new science fiction comic, and yes, as Pat said, you know, there was a gap for a space story, but with a character with so much history, with so much such a large fandom, and hadn't been published for some time by the time that 2000 AD came around, so to the point where you know, the kids who are reading the early issues of 2000 AD are the children of the kids who read the original Dan Dare. It seems odd to choose something with that much baggage.
Well, I suppose it's baggage in one way, but I mean, I thought in some ways that to have Dan Dare mentioned on the cover of the first issue and to have him quite often prominently on the cover was a ploy to get those dads to buy the comic for their kids. You know, as if, oh, son, this is what I used to love when I was a kid. But of course, the dads would then look at it, and it wasn't really what they read as a kid. But I always thought it was some sort of marketing ploy like that, because of course and of course, in the context of 2000 AD, Dan was a bit of a fish out of water, because the Eagle comic was kind of created as a response to American comics and American horror comics that you could buy in Britain in the early 50s. And in his earliest incarnation, Dare was actually like a space priest. He was a sort of a pastor or a, you know, not pastor as in spaghetti, but pastor, you know, a sort of vicar of space, because Marcus Morris, who created it, and Frank Hampson were quite devoted Christians, you know, whereas you probably couldn't imagine a more atheistic milieu than the early and indeed subsequent issues of 2000 AD. Yeah, there was a slight shock there. And I suppose, in a sense, the incarnations of Dan in 2000 AD, apart from the distinctive hooked eyebrows, which he has sported in all his incarnations, I suppose really he didn't have much relationship to the Eagle character. Although, as I say, when I was first offered the chance to draw the character, it was precisely that it was my inclination to draw on, because, you know, there was a pretty cohesive universe established there that I felt you could maybe darken a bit or maybe update a bit, but you know, perhaps not completely throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Yeah, there weren't that many elements that were left of the original beyond, as you say, the eyebrows and the name, really. And the Mekon, of course.
And the Mekon, because, you know, Dan is nothing if not one of those characters that is defined by his nemesis. You know, just as the Joker is really as important as Batman, then the Mekon is as important as Dan Dare. And you only have to mention Dan Dare to people of, say, my generation, and they go, "Oh, the Mekon, I remember the Mekon." Yeah. And he is, you know, kind of all, I mean, sometimes the best characters in the story are the villains. And I think the horrible Mekon with his kind of big dome and his super developed brain and his flying chair and his legions of obedient minions and his misuse of Venusian super science, you know, was such a wonderful, wonderful character. And of course, I mean, it also occurs to me that in a sociological sense, this was actually quite shortly after the end of World War II. And just as Dan, in a sense, was a reincarnation of an RAF pilot, you know, the Mekon in many ways personified evil Nazi science, you know.
So there
was a great resonance, I think, to the relationship between those two characters. And I certainly enjoyed drawing the Mekon, particularly in the Tom Tully stories, because Tom, you know, did kind of play on that kind of corrupt science aspect of things.
It was something I was going to talk to you about, and you've absolutely hit the nail on the head about the relationship between Dare and the Mekon being like Batman and the Joker. Because certainly in the later stories, the Tom Tully stories, the Mekon becomes this quite less kind of autocratic, less kind of dictatorial, less kind of, you know, almost pantomime villain-esque character, and becomes a lot more subtle. And the whole storyline where he brainwashes Dan into doing his bidding, there is that kind of really intense symbiotic relationship between them, where, you know, you've got the Mekon standing over Dare as he's on the floor and clutching his head because he doesn't know what's going on. He's completely lost his memory, and it's so much more than hero and villain. You know, there is this deep connection between them, and it's almost as if the Mekon understands that far better than Dare ever could.
Sure. Well, I mean, that is, as far as my meagre understanding of Greek drama, is exactly what Nemesis means. It means that you're tied to somebody that you can never escape, no matter how much you try. Just as Batman can never escape from the Joker, because in a sense, they're just the different sides of the same coin.
Yeah.
You know, in the same way that Dare, who's the kind of the sort of bright, as it were, yang side of science, where it's all about wonderful machines and exciting positive adventures and comradeship, you know, the Mekon is the yin of science, where it's everything is subverted to the cause of science and people's individual lives don't matter. It's just that, you know, this plan is carried forward. And I think Tom brought that across very nicely. And I think because I was also given the chance to draw the Mekon as sort of significantly older and even more raddled, with big dark spots on his dome and even more creases and even more sort of, you know, frail in a way. I like to think that did give him more depth. And I think probably throughout that whole storyline, you know, you could even look at it as being the Mekon story that Dan appeared in. So, yeah, I think there's some truth in that.
We've already mentioned the cliffhanger upon which Dan Dare finally ended in 1979. What did you go from Dan Dare on to do? Was it straight onto Rogue Trooper or?
I can't remember because it was sometime around then, I think, that I was kind of poached away, or I wasn't exactly poached away. I'd jumped ship, I suppose, would be a bit because I was kind of offered the chance to do Doctor Who,
right?
Which was a very appealing prospect to me, not least because I happened to know that Pat Mills and John Wagner had pitched a couple of Doctor Who stories to the BBC that they hadn't been successful in selling to them, and that that if I offered them the chance to recycle these plots as comic stories, I might finally get the chance to work at some length with Pat and John, because in all my career on 2000 AD, I hadn't really worked with them, and they were very up for it. So I actually found myself essentially working, you know, for a couple of 2000 AD writers, but just for a different publisher. So that was what I did after that. And there may have been a few future shocks and odds and sods sprinkled along the way. And I know I did some episodes of Roebusters as well with Pat, which I greatly enjoyed. Then I eventually came back to do Road Trooper. And many times I've sworn, right, that's it for me and Dan Dare. I'm never going to go near Dan Dare again. I've had my go at Dan Dare, but I did end up doing a cover for the, I think it was Virgin Comics got the rights to do Dan Dare for a short while.
Yes, they did.
And that was written by Garth Ennis, who's a friend of mine, and persuaded me to do a cover for that. And then, of course, just recently, the guys at 2000 AD, you know, asked me if I'd do a cover for this present collection. And I thought, oh, I don't know if I really want to. and then I was sent the PDFs, and I thought, you know what? This was actually, you know, this was actually quite good work, and it is of its time. And actually, it'd be quite nice just to draw Dan and the Fort and the Mekon and Hitman and Bear. And I really, really enjoyed doing the commission. And as I say, the whole enterprise seems to have been very well received by the readers. So, perhaps if they do a second collection, I might be tempted again. But I think there's only so many times you can swing your bat at the ball before you have to accept that you're actually out.
and sort of going through the old collection, like I said, when I read them for the first time, it was literally in this collection. You know, I was coming to it completely fresh. And you've said, you know, going through it, you think, oh, this is actually quite good. Is it just one of those nostalgia things where it's been such a part of your life, whether, you know, the formative thing about growing up reading Dan Dare, or whether that point in your career where you were working for 2000 AD and beginning to transition, you know, spread your wings, because you've done Harlem Heroes and you did Dan Dare and Road Trip and whatnot before going on to America. Is it just a nostalgia trip, or is it just one of those strips that inevitably draws you back because it's just such a rich world to live in?
Well, I mean, it is a rich world, but I mean, I think, like so many of us, I mean, you know, here's the thing: before 2000 AD, almost, which encapsulated a whole generation of us, people who worked in comics were doing it until they got something better to do, you know, until they could become like a proper magazine illustrator or a proper novelist, or they could edit a proper magazine like Practical Gardening. But people like me and Brian Bolland and Kevin O'Neill, Mick McMahon and Alan Moore and all those people, we wanted to do comics. That was our ambition. You know, that was the be all and end all to us. So clearly many of us, graduated to actually being able to draw characters that we loved as kids. And I mean, that's the sort of comic book equivalent of growing up loving, I don't know, Otis Redding and ending up singing with him on a record, you know, or playing with the Beatles or something like that, yeah. You know. And it's impossible to say no. And I mean, you don't always come up with the best work doing that, but there's always something really inspiring. I think after a while, and I've played with enough toys from other people's toy boxes, like all the DC characters, but you do reach a point where you think, well, maybe I should, you know, add something to it rather than just play with the toys. But yeah, I think to a large degree, it was that nostalgia. It was that boyhood dream come true aspect that drew me to Dan Dare. But you know, at the end of the day, if you enjoy doing the work and people enjoy reading it, and in retrospect, I think that's so of the Dan Dare stuff I did. You know, I think that's time quite well spent.
Yeah.
And I suppose I could have drawn just any run of the mill space hero, or we could have created a new space hero. But I think when it comes to space heroes, Dan Dare's just about the best, just as it with superheroes, Batman and Superman are just about the best, you know. Yeah. So I think if you get the chance to play with those toys, then you've been privileged, and it's hard to find too bad a downside to it.
Brilliant. Well, Dave, I'm afraid that's all we've got time for. We could talk until the cows come home about Dan Dare and about your work in particular. But thank you so much for coming on the Thrillcast.
Oh, I might. Thanks very much. You're welcome, and enjoy Dan Dare, all you of a new generation.
Brilliant. Thanks very much.
Cheers.
Cheers. Bye bye.
Bye bye.
And thanks again to Pat and to Dave for taking the time to chat to us about Dan Dare. Now, as already mentioned, the first collection of Dan Dare, the 2000 AD years, is out in stores in November. It makes an ideal Christmas gift. Nudge, nudge, wink, wink, say no more. So make sure you check it out. It's a gorgeous hardback with colour pages restored. The design droids and the repro droids have done a bang-up job on it. So it's definitely one for any self-respecting comic collectors collection. We will be back in 2 weeks with more from 2000 AD, the galaxy's greatest comic. I've been your host, Malt Char, and Splundig Verthrig, Earthlitz. Now, are you reading the galaxy's greatest comic? 2000 AD is in orbit every Wednesday from all good news agents and comic book stores. 2000 AD is also available digitally. You can get PDF copies, which are DRM-free, from our website at www.2000adonline.com, or you can download the free 2000 AD app for Apple and Android devices. Now, you get that by searching for 2000 space AD in iTunes and the Google Play Store. There's also the Judge Dredd magazine, which is published in print and digital every month with more pages, more Dredd-centric stories, special features, and a bagged reprint magazine featuring forgotten 2000 AD classics. And don't forget that our graphic novels, including absolute timeless classics like Strontium Dog, Ace Trucking, Flesh, Judge Dredd, Slain, Robo Hunter, and many, many more, are also available digitally through our webshop and app. We're on social media with the latest announcements, competitions and freebies. Search on Facebook and Google Plus for 2000 AD. If you're on Instagram, we're Insta 2000AD, and you can follow us on Twitter, where we are at 2000AD. Make sure you stay Zarjaz, Earthlitz. Splundig Verthrig.